I'd like to give my testimony that I love the Lord because he hath heard my voice and my supplications. Because he hath inclined his ear unto me, therefore will I call upon him as long as I live. God has been good to me. Goodness and mercy has followed me all the days of my life. I'd like to talk to you about the subject of true disciples. Familiar passage of scripture to a lot of you, but let's look at it and meditate on it again for a little while. Luke chapter 14, verses 25 through 35. Turn, please, to Luke chapter 14, verses 25 to 35. Doubtless, some of you have heard messages on this portion, but there's a lot here. And as I have been meditating and praying over it these last few days, I believe I'm just beginning now to get a little feel of what it's talking about. Would you follow, please, as I read? I'm using the King James Version tonight. And there went great multitudes with him. And he turned and said unto them, If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it? Lest haply, after he hath laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all that behold it began to mock him, saying, This man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends some envoys and desires conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land, nor yet for the dunghill, but men cast it out. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Now in this passage, it points out that great multitudes followed Jesus. He had been going around the countryside preaching the gospel, healing the sick, aggravating and confounding the Pharisees, scribes, and other leaders. People liked to hear the gospel preached. They crowded around to have the sick healed, and they all enjoyed a good fight. He was popular. Great multitudes followed him. And then it says, and he turned. In fact, one scripture says, or one translation rather, all at once, he turned and said, If any man come to me and does not do this, 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 and this, he cannot be my disciple. And unless he does such and such, he cannot be my disciple. And again, unless he does so and so, he cannot be my disciple. Three times he turned to them and said, unless you do this, you cannot be my disciple. It's almost as though he turned on them. He's saying, now, look, if any man come to me, and you're welcome to come, But if you do, understand that just hanging around me does not make you a disciple. I'm not looking for multitudes. Why, they'll follow you for what they get out of it. In John 6, he said, you don't follow me because you saw the miracles, but because you ate of the bread and were filled. Also in John 6, they left him in the crisis. In the last week of his life here on earth, on Palm Sunday, they lined the streets and yelled and called out, Hosanna. And 5 days later, on Good Friday, some of those very ones yelled out, Crucify him. He's not interested in just the multitudes. They'll turn on you. There's quite a startling illustration of this to me in Acts chapter 14, verses 18 and 19, concerning the Apostle Paul, where it says, And with these sayings, scarce restrained they the people that they had not done sacrifice unto them. Here these people were so taken up, apparently, with Paul and his companions that they could hardly keep them from doing sacrifice to them. And the very next verse says, And there came thither certain Jews from Antioch and Iconium who persuaded the people, and having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, supposing he had been dead. You just can't count on multitudes. It isn't multitudes you are looking for. This is not a popularity contest. Jesus says, I'm looking for true disciples. Jesus is out recruiting. That's what he's doing. And at this point, apparently he decides it's time to turn and to separate the men from the boys, the women from the girls, or to borrow it and just change a little bit from the Marines. He says, I'm looking for a few good people. Now, the effectiveness for God of this audience, as impressive as it is not measured by its numbers, but by the true disciples that are sitting here. Some of us have been around for some little time, and we have quite a collection of conference pictures. And we look at a conference and say, look at that, 300. You remember way back there we had 300. Now, where are some of those now? Boy, I don't know. We thought big things were happening, but where are they? I think that Jesus is pointing out here that when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of who's going to carry the load, let's not get fooled by numbers. Let's remember its dedication. True disciples. So Jesus goes on here to point out the requirements for true disciples. Now, you're familiar with them, but let's think about them again. Verse 26. If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Now, he said one requirement is you are to hate your family and yourself. Well, now, how do we think about that? Isn't one of the Ten Commandments, doesn't it say, honor thy father and thy mother? Did the Apostle Paul say that husbands are to love their wives, not hate them? Doesn't the Bible point out that parents are to care for their children? Well, this idea of hate, it means to prize less dearly, or to have less of a preference for by comparison. It may be that one of you girls, you ladies, would go into a department store and the lady's ready to wear and you're standing around there, you're looking at something, you say, ooh, I hate that. The little lady's, oh, I love this. Well, I don't know if you hate that or really love this. Maybe what you're saying is I have a strong preference of this over that. Well, that's what it's talking about here. We're to have a strong preference for Jesus over our family and over ourselves. So when it comes to being a true disciple, there must be no doubt about who comes first, because Jesus will tolerate no rivals. Now he comes before the family, before father and mother. I know some on the staff who God seemed to be leading them to go into the Lord's work full time. And in several instances that I can think of right now, dad had hoped that son would take over the business. And in those cases, one case it was tears as dad realized his son was not going to take over the business. And another was anger as he realized his son did not feel that that's where the Lord was leading him. But at least in those two instances in my mind today, both dads are very happy and proud of their sons, though it was rough going at the time. But where there's a conflict of interest, Jesus makes it very clear. He must come first. You follow him. What about your wife? I heard it said that one man out of 1,000 is a leader of men. The other 999 are followers of women. Who rules the roost around there? You know, this begins in your courtship days. I don't know, as I look out here, I think most of you look like you're relatively young. Probably less married here than married. Putting Jesus first starts in your courtship days. I remember one time when a young fella came to me and he wanted some help, and I was trying to impress upon him the quiet time, and he was trying to impress upon me that he didn't have time for a quiet time. I said, "Do you have a girlfriend?" He answered, "Yes, I do." I said, "How many nights a week do you go over to see her?" He said, "Do we have to go into this?" I said, "Yes." "Oh," he said, "about 5 nights a week. I said, "What time do you usually get there?" "Oh, about 7:30. I said, "What time do you leave?" Then he said it again. Do we have to go into that? I said, "Yes." "Well," he said, I get out on the porch about 11. "Well, what time do you leave?" "Well, maybe about 11:30. And, he's doing pretty well compared to some. But okay, 5 nights a week, 4 hours a night, 20 hours a week, and you mean to tell me that you can't get 15 minutes a day alone with Jesus Christ? Who is first in your life? My first assignment when I came with the Navigators was here in Southern California. I was in charge of high school Bible clubs. We had about 35 of them in the LA area when I first came. Now, I was in charge of the leaders, and I led some of these myself. And I had one club of high school fellows. We met on Saturday night. And man, we had a great time. And these fellows were growing in their dedication to Christ. They all had girlfriends. And apparently their girlfriends got together and decided that they wanted to have a party. And that the only time they could have it was on a Saturday night. So they invited the fellows to this party and so on, and the guy said, we can't come. "Well, why not?" I didn't know about this till after it was all over. Well, in fact, till the following week, and you'll see how I found out. "Well," they said, "we have our Bible study on Saturday night." Well, the girls say, we don't have parties all the time. You have Bible studies every week. You could give it up at least once." "Oh, no," they said, "we couldn't do that." And some of the girls threatened to quit going with those guys if they didn't come to their party on that given Saturday night. And they said, "Well, that's the way it'll have to be." And you know that the following week, most all of those girls trooped into the Navigator office in downtown L.A. asking if they could have a Bible study for them. Now, there's where it begins. That's right. That's putting Jesus Christ first. What about children? Jesus said, you've got to put me before your children. And I wonder sometimes today, who really is the head of the home? Dad may think he is, Mom may think she's the neck and turns dad, but little old Johnny over there, he's the head of the home. Boy, he knows how to make people run. He knows how to be the center of attention. He knows how to get all the plans changed for little old Johnny. And we get overprotective and at the same time overpermissive. And who's the head of the house? Little old 7-year-old Johnny. I think some parents today are following their children. Can you believe that? I think it's true. They go, why did Jesus say, you got to follow me before you follow your children? Well, I think there's some like that. I remember a friend of mine was speaking to a group, and someone reported this to me. He said, tell me in 3 words, what do you think is the greatest thing you can do for your children? So various people came up with various answers, and then he gave his. And his answer was this. In 3 words, the greatest thing you can do for your children is to love your wife. Well, I thought that sounded real good. That is good. But some weeks later, as I was reflecting on this more, I said, I think I can improve on that. The greatest thing you can do for your children, as well as your wife, is first and above all, to honor the Lord. Honor the Lord. You remember Hannah prayed that God would give her a son, and he did. Gave her Samuel. So Hannah took her little child, Samuel, and brought him to the temple and turned him over to Eli, the priest. She gave him to the Lord. She went off home. And Eli raised that boy, Samuel. But Eli had 2 sons of his own. And those sons became so wicked that God killed them. And yet Samuel, growing up in the very same environment, turned out to be this great man of God. What made the difference? Same environment and all the rest. Well, the Bible says that Eli knew that his sons were sinning. He did not restrain them. That was one thing. Another thing, it says that he did not bring them up to know the Lord. But I think there's something even more important. Because one night the Lord told Samuel, he said, Eli has honored his sons above me. Whereas Hannah had honored the Lord above her son. I think the greatest thing that a parent can do for their children is to honor the Lord, put him first. And in such a way that it's obvious that he's first. And then your brothers and sisters. Well, who's first in your life? Your family or Jesus? You know something else? I really believe that if you put Jesus first, then you will be able to really honor your parents. And no one can really love his wife like the one who puts Jesus first before his wife. And no one can care for his children like the one who puts Jesus first. Do you know, Jesus goes on here. Now he says, you've got to prefer me above your family. But he says, yea, and his own life also. I've got to come before you, before yourself. You know, as you read through the Bible, the Gospels, isn't it absolutely beautiful, the balance in Jesus' statements? And think of this one right here. All right, he's saying, all right, now what you've got to do is you've got to prize less dearly your family. I've got to be first. And somebody says, okay, all right. And then Jesus says, and also I've got to be ahead of you, yourself. And the reason I like the beauty of this statement, the balance of it is, that I personally think I have met more than one sort of religious adventurer who says he's given up his family, his father, mother, wife, children, for Jesus. But he's never given up himself. And in fact, he didn't really leave home for Jesus' sake. He left home because he couldn't get along with his wife. Or because he just couldn't take the kids are driving up a wall, and he wanted to sidestep his responsibility as a husband and a father. And that man ought to stay home for Jesus' sake. You know, doesn't Jesus have a way of putting his finger right on it? He said, all right, I want you to prize less dearly your family, but your own self also. Now he says here, yea, and his own life also. Now I looked that up. That word there means the central part of you, your mind, your emotions, and your will. And so Jesus is saying here in verse 26, if you are going to be my disciple, then what I think must have priority over what you think. And what I feel must have first place precedence over what you feel. And what I will must dominate what you will. And I thought, again, that song, I'll go where you want me to go, dear Lord. I'll say what you want me to say. Not what I want to say, but what you want me to say. And I'll be what you want me to be. Not what I would want me to be, but what you want me to be. Whether that's prominence or obscurity. Whether it's success or whether it's failure outwardly. Whatever it is, Lord, as long as I know that you have led me. That's all I ask. That's all I ask. I just want to be a true follower of Jesus Christ. How about you? Well, Jesus goes on. See, here he's talking about the costs in this passage. He isn't necessarily talking about all the blessings, of which there are many. This is kind of a tough way to put it. And the reason is, I suggested a moment ago, that he's recruiting. So he goes on and says, whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Now a cross. You know, we wear attractive crosses and made out of very beautiful things. But you know, really, a cross is a sign of trouble. A cross is a sign that something has gone wrong. Really, a cross to me is not beautiful. In fact, it ought to make us shudder, like the sight of an electric chair, or a hangman's noose, or a gas chamber. Because we live in a world gone wrong that has rebelled against God, and it took a cross to get to the heart of it. Not nice little talks. Not polite little thoughts. Psalm 9 says that all of us, the whole world, we have sunk down in the pit that we made. And we're down in a mire of sin. And we don't need someone to come along and look down there as we're struggling and stuck and drop down a little poem for us to read. Or for someone to look down and say, if you'd been more careful, you wouldn't have gotten in that mess. Or someone to come along and say, God is love and love is God. And there we sit. I mean, it needs somebody to come, and who's able to come down and lift us up out of that pit of sin. And that meant somebody had to pay for that penalty, which is death. And that took a cross. We live in a world gone wrong. And Jesus is looking for people to help put it right. And that takes a lot more than just pleasant little devotionals. And a cross is a place of suffering. And this is where I'd like to get out. I don't like pain of any kind. Not even hunger pains, no kind of pain. But he says, take up a cross, and it's a place of suffering, and this is where we want to cop out. And yet it says that Jesus himself learned obedience by the things that he suffered. You ever thought about the three great problems of man? Sin, suffering, and death. Here we are, we're Christians, we're on our way to heaven, our sins are forgiven. But we still have sin to contend with. We still have suffering to contend with, and unless the Lord comes sooner, we have death to face. But our sins are forgiven as Christians. Suffering has purpose. It is not purposeless. It is purposeful. And as far as death is concerned, it has lost its sting. It really has. But God didn't remove sin from us. He hasn't taken suffering away from us. Christians suffer as do others physically in various ways. And we need to remember that in spiritual work, and I suppose in others, that suffering and success go together. That's right. And as someone has put it, if you are suffering without succeeding, it's that someone might succeed after you. And if today you are succeeding in some spiritual ministry, it's because someone suffered ahead of you. Somebody has prayed, somebody has worked, somebody has sowed the seed, and you have come along and reaped where others have sown. But in God's work, in Jesus' work, being a follower of his, suffering and success go together. There never was a feast without a sacrifice. Someone always pays. Salvation is free to us, but it cost heaven the best he'd had in Jesus. Leadership. Some of us, we might aspire to leadership. And I like what one book I read said about leadership. Leadership is simply paying a price. And when you quit paying the price, you quit leading. It's just that simple, and it's just that difficult. A cross. Well, do you still want to follow me? Do you still want to be my disciple? Let's go a little further. It's his own cross. It's not Jesus' cross. It's your cross. I'll guarantee you this. That you think of anyone that you know that has been really used of God, has been used of God for some time. You get to know them and you probe a little deeper and you look down a little deeper and you will find that they're bearing a secret cross of some kind. The Apostle Paul had the thorn in the flesh that God would not remove. As one of my friends in the Navigators told me one time, and I was kind of going through it, and what to us was a real heavy burden in our situation. He said, Lauren, you know, we've got to remember that God not only expects us to run this race, but sometimes we have to run it with a 40-pound pack on our back. And that's true. He says to bear your own cross, carry it. And not only carry it, but persevere in carrying it. As long as he leaves it with you to carry it. If he takes it away, okay. If not, as in the case of Paul, all right, his grace is sufficient. And Paul wrote to Timothy and said, now, Timothy, take your share of suffering for the gospel. Carry your part of the load. See, Jesus doesn't want us to be deluded about this thing. And sometimes we kind of rock along, we trot up to Jesus, Jesus, I'll follow you wherever you go. Just a minute. Do you know what's involved? Really? See, there's a war on. This is an enemy-occupied planet we live on. And there's a fierce conflict raging. And it erupts in all kinds of things around the world that we read on the front page of the daily newspaper. And he said, I've got something to do with that. I'm looking for people to help me in that problem. So he says, take up your cross and come after me. But you know, we've got to remember something about that cross. That cross isn't something you just kind of grit your teeth and you're going to bear it and you know it's tough going. But you have to be like Jesus. And I'm trying to learn this. And we've all got to try to learn it. Said, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross? And there's joy in following Jesus. There really is. And for me, there has ever been since that night I got down beside my bed and received Christ into my life. But Jesus also wants us to note here in this passage that all is not peaches and cream. So don't be surprised if it isn't. Because there are a lot of Christians, young Christians especially, they're getting along well, and the next thing you know, something, bang, it hits them, and they think, oh, what have I done? I've sinned. There must be something wrong. Maybe I'm not saved. No, that isn't it at all. You're in a battle. That's par for the course. But don't worry. He'll let it happen. But also, he won't let you have more than you can bear. So Jesus says, and are you still willing to follow me? Well, I think we better stop for a minute and find out, is it worth, what is it we're doing all this for, shall we? We go on to verse 28. Now, Jesus stops here and said, in essence, to say, now, why are the requirements so tough? Why do I put it so strong? Well, he says, now, you can understand it, why that is, if you just think about it for a moment. So he gives two illustrations. He said, now, suppose you were going out to build a tower, a big building, a skyscraper. Wouldn't you sit down first and count the cost and see whether or not you've got enough money to finish the structure? Lest you start to build and you've only got money enough for the foundation and you can't finish it, and people come and say, huh, look at that. You mock you and say, well, you started a build and you couldn't finish. You didn't count the cost. You didn't think it through. Or he uses the second illustration. He said, or suppose you were a king. You're going out to make war against another king, and you find out you've got 10,000 men and he has 20,000 men. Well, you'd sit down and think that through, whether or not you with 10,000 men could meet this one with 20,000. And if not, well, you'd try to make some arrangements to make a truce with him. He says, that's what I've done. You see, about 6 months before, Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. He said, I've come into this world to build people. That's what his church is, made up of people. And I'm going to use those people to go down and assail the gates of hell, where people are held captive by Satan, and we're going to win them, transfer them from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light, and build them up and use them to go down and win some more, to bring them back, to build them up, to go down and win some more. To build and do battle. To build and do battle. Now, Jesus is saying here, I think, I'm the builder. That's why I came into this world. Also, he's saying, I am the warrior king. And I came in this world to do battle with the devil. In fact, 1 John 3:8 says he came to destroy the works of the devil. Now he says, since that's why I came, I want people to follow me that I can count on. People who will be with me until the building is done and the battle is won. Can I count on you? Will you be a true disciple? Will you stick with me and build people up and go down and win them and bring them back, build them up and go down and win them, bring them back, build them up until my kingdom is extended around the world? All right, verse 33, so likewise, like the builder, you count the cost. Like the battler, the warrior king, you think it through. And then you come and join me in the greatest enterprise in the history of mankind. And if you're going to do that, all I ask is that you forsake all that you have and come and join me. That's the requirement. Well, you say, what else is there? You already talked about my family, my father, my mother, my wife, children, brothers and sisters, and in a lot of societies that's a tougher decision to make than it is in ours. Then you've also talked about myself, and about bearing a cross, leaving my comforts and taking a cross. Well, what else is there? Well, there's things. There's everything. Do things have you, or do you have them? Jesus said things will choke the word. Maybe we've gotten into debt for things, and anybody in debt is unavailable. You're immobile. And we've gotten so captivated with things that we've made ourselves unavailable to the Lord. How are you going to follow him then wherever he leads? I'll go where you want me to go, dear Lord, when I've paid off that money I've gotten in debt, just so I could have some things and live above my income. Do we hold things loosely? Well, I can't go over there. They don't have enough golf courses over there. Or the things I like. I'll go where you want me to go, dear Lord, as long as there are no bugs there. Our comforts, whatever it is. Oh, yeah, we kind of laugh at that. I know one missionary couple got on the mission field, so they had a maid come to help, and you have to because it takes so much longer to get things done, and you have to go to language school. And this dear girl, this young bride with the little kids, one thing she had never committed to the Lord were her wedding presents. And if you could see the kind of a hubble that the maid would come from, you'd understand why she couldn't handle those wedding presents. And she broke some of them. And that young bride was absolutely crestfallen and just completely shaken. And then to add another little thing, the mosquitoes are biting her dear little one, and they kind of festered. Sometimes it takes about 6 months or so till the allergy to your special allergic situation to mosquitoes gets over. But those little things, and you know, they left that mission field, they've never been back. Not necessarily some big sin that gets you out of the will of God or puts you on the shelf. It can be things, just things, little things. What about your job? I like to go up in the company. I need to get a little bit more money salted away for a rainy day, and we sell our souls to it. I was talking not long ago with a man that maybe some of you know. I won't mention his name. He said, he just told me privately, he said, you know, I've been offered the presidency of about 14 or 15 colleges and organizations, and I've declined them all. Because deep in my soul, he's just telling me this personally, he said, I want above all else just to be like Jesus, to cultivate likeness to Christ and to follow him. He said, I'm not sure that I, as a father and with my particular gifts, could take those jobs as prominent as they might make me and all the rest and still really be like Jesus. And he said, even today with my present position, if I felt that that was in the way of just being like Jesus, I'd quit it and go to digging ditches or whatever job I could get. Just enough to supply some food and housing for mother and me, and our children are gone. He said, that's all. Now that's what it's talking about. There's a true disciple. And you could go on and on and on. And some of you may be saying right now, in a couple of ways, how long is this going to go on? Well, this isn't going to go on too long. But how long is the other going to go on? I mean, this question about things, about this, that, and the other. You know how long it'll go along? All your life. Right on down to the end. Sorry, cheer up, folks. It's going to get worse. But you know what's going to be better? Also, fruitfulness will carry on right on down to the end. And you will be like Psalm 92:14. They still bring forth fruit in old age. They are ever full of sap and green. And you keep making your new dedications, your new commitments as Jesus calls upon you to make them all through your life, right on down to the end, and you will continue to be fruitful right on down to the end. And your life will be filled with the joy that comes from victories won. And you know something else? You'll be good for something. Jesus winds his passengers up, said, "Salt is good." Are you good for something? But if it lost its saltiness, if it's lost its tang, if it's lost its bite, it's not even good for the manure pile. Men throw it out. Are you any good? Well, a disciple, a true disciple, is good. They're salty. A week or two ago at Glen Eyrie, night, I told the gang there I was going to do this, and I'm going to do it right now. I want to tell you something, my own testimony. And I'm about finished. Up in Modesto, California, where I came to know the Lord. One night in a meeting, something like this, my girlfriend and I were there. Now my wife. And there was a message. I don't recall what the message was, but it was a challenge to follow Jesus. So they gave an invitation that night for all those who had never made the decision before and would like to do so, to come down front as a public testimony to their decision to follow Jesus wherever he led. And Lucy and I did that. We came down front, we stood there, and we meant that. We didn't know all that that entailed, but we meant it. And I suppose there have been a dozen other times in my life since then, certain critical points where there was a new dedication that was required, a new commitment, a new surrender, a new saying to Jesus, "I'll go where you want me to go. I'll say what you want me to say. I'll be what you want me to be." I remember up at Mount Hermon, down by that little creek, when God met me and talked to me, I made a new surrender. Or up at Hume Lake, and some of you have been there, and there's a big boulder out there. Every time I go to Hume Lake, I go to that boulder because there was a new surrender I had to make in my life. Then at Glen Eyrie, up there by Echo Rock, and I can see it yet. My wife and I parked in the car, a few tears, some prayer, some surrender. Okay, Lord, I'll go. And that meant about 6 months to be gone, and I'd been gone. I've been gone 6 months a year from home for about 23 years now. And I got kind of tired of that. So there have been some new surrenders, new yieldings were necessary. Then I remember about the six kids, and Lord, what am I going to do? I've been told by some people if I keep running around like this, my kids will all grow up to serve the devil. So one afternoon, I just got away from the Billy Graham Crusade in Scotland and went out on the shores of Loch Lomond. I'd always sung about Loch Lomond. Well, I sat out on the shores of that lake, and there that afternoon all over again, I just said, "Lord, I'll follow you wherever you want me to go. You'll take care of those six kids. You'll take care of them." And you know something that happened? I wasn't going to tell this, but I'll toss it in. It's worth it. I came home from that trip, and I'd only been home just that day. And a neighbor lady came in to us later in the afternoon. She said, she was very upset about something. She said, "I want to tell you what happened." She said a neighbor boy, and she named him, went into his garage and got a rifle, went out in the backyard, and he put a shell in it, and he pointed it at your son's chest. And I yelled at him to stop it. He said, "Oh, it's okay, it's on safety," and he pulled the trigger. And my wife and I, as we went to bed that night, we talked about it, and we said, "You know, that boy is as safe in the hands of the Lord when I am 6,000 miles away as he is when we were just 50 feet. The Lord is well able to take care of him. In fact, you've got to take care of me if you're home all the time. God has to do it." And then last fall, I don't know, I guess I I began to think, you know, Lord, let's give somebody else a chance and let the younger guys, they like to get on the airplanes. And I've been most places and didn't lose anything there and don't feel like going back to find it if I did. And besides, you know, Lord, give the younger guys a chance. They like to travel, and I'll just stay home, and, man, I could have a ministry at Glen Eyrie. But last spring, I just had to go up by Doss's grave, Doss Trotman's grave there at Glen Eyrie. I don't do this very often. But I went up there, and that afternoon, just by myself, I just said, Lord, once more, I want to just rededicate myself to go where you want me to go. Anywhere in the world. And for however long you want me to go. And say what you want me to say. And do what you want me to do. And be what you want me to be. And all I'm just going to ask you to say, yes, Lord, I'll do it. I'll be a true disciple. I'll follow you. And I'm just going to ask you, if in the private of your own heart, if you will join me in a new dedication and a new surrender to Jesus, maybe something major you've been struggling with, or maybe never in your life before have you just said to Jesus, I'll follow you. I'll pay that price. I'll be a true disciple. And changing a little bit of what it says up here, but using that last sentence, that whether as others do this or not, I will. I will. Now, if God has been speaking to you about something, and you know what it is, I wouldn't. Maybe about being a true disciple or some new area of surrender. We're going to pray right now. In the quiet of your own heart, you talk it over with him, will you? Right here, right where you sit. Not waiting till we get back to our room. Who knows what will happen between here and there and what might distract us. Right here is our place of surrender. Right here. It's not a boulder near a lake. It's not Loch Lomond. It isn't by the Glen Eyrie or Echo Rock. It's right here. And let this be a private place for each one of us, as though there's no one else here. And just talk to the Lord right now. Right now. Maybe you should tell him that you've never told him before, Lord, I want to make you complete Lord of my life. I want to be a true disciple. Put you first before all else. Or if there's something you've been struggling with, some surrender you believe the Lord has been talking to you about, but you haven't surrendered, do that. Tell him about it right now.